with Bill Moyers. Program 6, Masks of Eternity.
We want to think about God. God is a thought. God is an idea. But its reference is to something that transcends all thinking. I mean, he's beyond being, beyond the category of being and non-being. Is he or is he not? Neither is nor is not. Every god, every mythology, every religion is true in this sense. It is true as metaphorical of the human and cosmic mystery. He who thinks he knows doesn't know. He who knows that he doesn't know, knows. There is an old story that is still good. Story of the quest, the spiritual quest. That is to say, to find the inward thing which you basically are. All of these symbols in mythology refer to you. Have you been reborn? Have you died to your animal nature and come to life as a human incarnation? You are God in your deepest identity. You are one with the transcendent.
Joseph Campbell and the Power of Myth with Bill Moyers. Masks of Eternity.
The images of God are many. Joseph Campbell called them the masks of eternity and said they both cover and reveal the face of glory. All our names and images for God are masks, Campbell said. They signify that ultimate reality, which by definition transcends language and art. A myth is a mask of God, too, a metaphor for what lies behind the visible world. As teacher, scholar, and writer, Joseph Campbell spent his life in the study of comparative religion. He wanted to know what it means that God assumes such different masks in different cultures. We go east of Suez and see people dancing before a bewildering array of fantastic gods. When those people come here, well, Campbell told the story of the young Hindu who called on him in New York and said, "When I visit a foreign country, I like to acquaint myself with its religion. So I bought myself a Bible, and for some months now I've been reading it from the beginning. But you know, I can't find any religion in it." Campbell, who became president of the American Society for the Study of Religion, was at home in the sacred scriptures of all the world's great faiths. He found comparable stories in them, stories of creation, of virgin births, incarnations, death and resurrection, second comings, judgment days. Quoting one of his favorite Hindu scriptures, which he translated from the Sanskrit, he concluded that truth is one. The sages speak of it by many names. Joseph Campbell began his journey into this literature of the spirit after his imagination was excited by a visit to the Museum of Natural History in New York when he was just a boy. We met there a few months before his death and talked through a long evening about the masks of eternity.
Is there something in common in every culture that creates this need for God?
Well, I think anyone who has an experience of mystery at all knows that there is a dimension, let's say, of the universe that is not that which is available to his senses. There's a wonderful saying in one of the Upanishads, when for a sunset or a mountain and the beauty of this or of that, you pause and say, ah, that is participation in divinity. And I think that's what it is. It's the realization of wonder and also the experience of tremendous power, which people, of course, living in the world of nature are experiencing all the time. You know, there's something there that's much bigger than the human dimension. And our way of thinking in the West largely is that God is the source of the energy. The way in most Oriental thinking, and I think in most what we call primitive thinking also, is that God is a manifestation of the energy, not its source. That God is the vehicle of the energy. And the level of energy that is involved or represented determines the character of the God. There are gods of violence. There are gods of compassion. There are gods that unite the two. There are gods that are the protectors of kings in their war campaigns. These are personifications of the energy that's in play. And what the source of the energy is, what's the source of the energy of these lights around us? I mean, this is a total mystery.
Doesn't this make of faith an anarchy, a sort of continuing war among principalities?
As life is, yes. I mean, even in your mind, when it comes to do anything, there will be a war, a decision as to priorities, what you're to do now. Or in relationship to other people, there will be four or five possibilities of my way of action. And the notion of divinity or divine life in my mind would be what would determine my decision. And if it were rather crude, it would be a rather crude decision.
But is divinity just what we think?
Yes.
What does that do to faith?
Well, it's a tough one about faith.
You are a man of faith. You're a man of wonder.
Yeah, I don't have to have faith. I have experience.
What kind of experience?
Well, I have experience of the wonder of the life. I have experience of love. I have experience of hatred, malice. I like to punch the guy's jaw. And I admit this. But those are different divinities. I mean, from the point of view of a symbolic imaging, those are different images operating in me. For instance, when I was a little boy and was being brought up a Roman Catholic, I was told I had a guardian angel on my right side and a tempting devil on my left. And when it came to making a decision of what I would do, the decision would depend on which one had most influence on me. And I must say that in my boyhood, and I think also in the people who were teaching me, they actually concretized those thoughts.
It did what?
It was an angel. That angel is a fact, and the devil is a fact, do you see? Otherwise, one thinks of them as metaphors for the energies that are afflicting and guiding you.
And those energies come from?
From your own life. The energy of your own body, the different organs in your body, including your head, are the conflict systems.
And your life comes from where?
Yeah, there you are. From the ultimate energy that's the life of the universe. And then you say, well, somebody has to generate that. Why do you have to say that? Why can't it be impersonal? That would be Brahman. That would be the transcendent mystery that you can also personify.
Can men and women live with an impersonality?
Yes. They do all over the place. Just go east of Suez. In the East, the gods are much more elemental.
Elemental?
Elemental. Less human and more like the powers of nature. I see a deity as representing an energy system. And part of the energy system is the human energy systems of love and malice, hate, benevolence, compassion. And in Oriental thinking, the God is the vehicle of the energy, not its source.
Well, of course, the heart of the Christian faith is that these elemental forces you're talking about embodied themselves in a human being and reconciling mankind to God.
Yes. And the basic Buddhist idea is that that is true of you as well. And that what Jesus was a person who realized that in himself and lived out of the Christhood of his nature.
What do you think about Jesus?
We just don't know Jesus. All we know are four contradictory texts that tell us what he did.
Written many years after he lived.
But I think we know what Jesus said. I think the sayings of Jesus are probably pretty close. But when you read the Thomas Gospel, the Gospel according to Thomas, which was dug up there in that with those other Gnostic texts, it has all the flavor of one of the synoptics, Matthew, Mark, or Luke, except that it doesn't say quite the same thing. There's one wonderful passage, it's the last one in the Gospel, actually. When will the kingdom come? Now, in Mark 13, I think it is, we hear that the end of the world is going to come. That's to say, a mythological image, that's the end of the world, is taken as a reference to an actual physical historical fact to be. When you read the Thomas Gospel, Jesus says, the kingdom of the Father will not come by expectation. The kingdom of the Father is spread upon the earth, and men do not see it. So I look at you now in that sense, and the radiance of the presence of the divine is known to me through you.
Through me?
You, sure.
A journalist?
Jesus also says in this text, he who drinks from my mouth will become as I am, and I shall be he. He's talking from the point of view of that being of beings which we call the Christ, who is the being of all of us. And anyone who lives in relation to that is as Christ. And anyone who incarnates, or rather brings into his life the message of the word, is equivalent to Jesus. That's the sense there.
So that's what you mean when you say, I am radiating God to you.
You are, yes.
And you to me.
And I'm speaking this seriously.
No, I take it seriously. I happen to believe the same as you without being able to articulate it as you do. I do sense that there is divinity. The divinity is in the other.
So you are the vehicle. You are, as it were, radiant of the Spirit. And that's why not recognize it?
I'll tell you what the most gripping scripture in the Christian New Testament is for me. It says, I believe, help thou my unbelief.
I believe in what?
I believe in this ultimate reality. And that I can experience it, that I do experience it. But I don't have answers to my questions. I believe in the question. Is there a God?
I had a very amusing experience, which it might be well worth telling. I was in the New York Athletic Club swimming pool. And you know, you don't wear your collar this way or that way when you're in a swimming pool. And I was introduced to a priest. This is Father so-and-so. This is Joseph Campbell. I'm a professor. He's a professor at one of our Catholic universities. So after I'd had my swim, I came and sat down beside, in what we call, you know, the horizontal athlete situation, and the priest is beside me. And he said, Mr. Campbell, are you a priest? I said, no, Father. He said, are you a Catholic? I said, I was, Father. He said, and now he had the sense to ask it this way, do you believe in a personal God? I said, no, Father. And he said, well, I suppose there is no way to prove by logic the existence of a personal God. And I said, if there were, Father, what would be the value of faith? Well, Mr. Campbell, it's nice to have met you, and he was off. I really felt I'd done a jujitsu trick there. But that was a very illuminating conversation to me. The fact that he asked, do you believe in a personal God? That meant that he also recognized the possibility of the Brahman, of the transcendent energy.
Well, then what is religion?
Well, the word religion means religio, linking back. Linking back the phenomenal person to a source. If we say it is the one life in both of us, then my separate life has been linked to the one life, religio, linked back.
And this
becomes symbolized in the images of religion, which represent that connecting link.
Your friend Jung, the great psychologist, says that the most powerful religious symbol is the circle. He says, the circle is one of the great primordial images of mankind, that in considering the symbol of the circle, we are analyzing the self. And I find you in your own work throughout the course of your life coming across the circle, whether it's in the magical designs the world over, whether it's in the architecture, both ancient and modern, whether it's in the dome-shaped temples of India or the calendar stones of the Aztecs or the ancient Chinese bronze shields or the visions of the Old Testament prophet Ezekiel, whom you talk about, the wheel in the sky. You keep coming across this image.
Yeah, it's an ever-present thing. It's the center from which you've come, back to which you go. I remember reading in a book about the American Indians called The Indian Book by Natalie Curtis. It was published around 1904. Her conversation with a chief, I think he was a chief of the Pawnee tribe. And among the things he said was, when we pitch camp, we pitch a camp in a circle. When we look at the horizon is in a circle. When the eagle builds a nest, the nest is in a circle. And then you read in Plato somewhere, the soul is a circle. I suppose the circle represents a totality. Within the circle is one thing. It is encircled. It's enframed. That would be the spatial aspect. But the temporal aspect of the circle is you leave, go somewhere, and come back. The Alpha and Omega. God is the Alpha and Omega, the source and the end. Somehow the circle suggests immediately a completed totality, whether in time or in space.
No beginning, no end.
Well, round and round and round. The year. Well, this is November again, you know, and we're about to have Thanksgiving again, and we're about to have Christmas again. And then not only the year, but the month, the moon cycle, and the day cycle. And this is, we're reminded of this when we look on our watch and see the cycle of time. It's the same hour, but another day and all that sort of thing.
Why do you suppose the circle became so universally symbolic?
Well, because it's experienced all the time. You experience it in the day and the year, just as we've said. And you experience it in leaving home, going on your adventure, hunting, or whatever it may be, and coming back to home. And then there's a deeper one also, that mystery of the womb and the tomb. When people are buried, it's for rebirth. I mean, that's the origin of the burial idea. You're put back into the womb of Mother Earth for rebirth.
And Jung kept returning to that theme of the circle as being the sort of universal symbol.
Well, Jung used it as a pedagogical device, actually, he called the mandala. This was actually a Hindu term for a sacred circle.
Here is one of the pictures
That's a very elaborate mandala. You have the deity, the center, with the power source, the illumination source, and these are the manifestations or aspects of its radiance. But in working out a mandala for oneself, what one does is draw a circle and then think of the different impulse systems in your life, the different value systems in your life, and try then to compose them and find what a center is. It's a kind of discipline for pulling all those scattered aspects of your life together, finding a center and ordering yourself to it. So you're trying to coordinate your circle with the universal circle.
To be at the center.
At the center. The Navajo have that wonderful image of what they call the pollen path. And when you realize what pollen is, it's the life source. And it's a single path, the center. And then they will say, you know, beauty before me, beauty behind me, beauty to the right of me, beauty to the left of me, beauty above me, beauty below me. I'm on the pollen path. So the little cosmos of one's own life and the macrocosm of the world's life are in some way to be coordinated. Well, for instance, among the Navajo Indians, healing ceremonies were conducted by way of sand paintings, which are mostly mandalas, on the ground, and then the person who is to be treated moves into the mandala. There will be a mythological context that he will be identifying with, and he identifies himself with that power. And this idea of sand painting with mandalas and used for meditation purposes appears also in Tibet. In the great tantric monasteries outside of Lhasa, for instance, Gyutdo, they practiced sand painting, cosmic images and so forth, indicating the forces of the spiritual powers that operate in our lives.
Now, what do you make of that? That in two very different cultures, the same imagery emerges.
Yes. Well, there are only two ways to explain it, and one is by diffusion, that an influence came from there to here, and the other is by separate development. And when you have the idea of separate development, this speaks for certain powers in the psyche which are common to all mankind. Otherwise, you couldn't have, and to the detail the correspondences can be identified, it's astonishing when one studies these things in depth, the degree to which the agreements go between totally separated cultures.
Which says something about the commonality of the species, doesn't it?
Well, yes. That was Carl Jung's idea, which he calls the archetypes of the collective unconscious.
What do you mean by archetype?
An archetype is a constant form, a basic fundamental form which appears in the works of that person over there and this person over here without connection. And they are expressions of the structure of the human psyche.
So if you find in a variety of cultures, each one telling the story of creation, or the story of a virgin birth, or the story of a savior who comes and dies and is resurrected, you're saying something about what is inside us and the need to understand.
That's right. One can say that the images of myth are reflections of spiritual and depth potentialities of every one of us. And that through contemplating those, we evoke those powers in our own lives to operate through ourselves. There was a very important anthropologist, he's the one with whom my works begin, you might say, my studies, Bastian in Germany, end of the last century and first part of this. He was a world traveler and recognized very soon that there were certain motifs that appeared in all of the religions and all the mythologies of the world. such an idea, for example, as a spiritual power. That's an archetypal image that appears everywhere. And he called these elementary ideas. But they appear in very different forms in different provinces and at different times. And those different forms or costumes he called ethnic or folk ideas. But within the ethnic idea is the elementary idea. And it is those elementary ideas that Carl Jung then began studying and called archetypes of the unconscious. When you say elementary idea, they seem to come from up here. When you say archetypes of the unconscious, they come from up here. And they appear in our dreams as well as in the myths.
So when one scripture talks about being made in his image, in God's image, it's being created with certain qualities that every human being possesses, no matter what that person's religion or culture or geography or heritage.
God would be the ultimate elementary idea of man.
The primal need.
And we are all made in the image of God, okay? So that is the ultimate elementary idea or archetype of man.
I feel stronger in my own faith, knowing that others had the same yearnings and were seeking for the same images to try to express an experience that couldn't be costumed in ordinary human language.
I mean, that's right.
I feel much more kinship with all those who follow other ways because it's
this is why clowns are good
clown
religions, because they show that the image is not a fact, but it's a reflex of some kind.
So does this help explain the trickster gods that show up?
It's very much that, yes. Some of the best trickster stories are associated with our American Indian tales. Now, these figures are clown-like figures, and yet they are the creator god at the same time very often. And this makes the point, I am not the ultimate image. I am transparent to something. Through me, through my funny form, and mocking it and turning it into a grotesque action, you really get the sense, which if I had been a big sober presence, you'd get stuck with the image.